Turning around low-performing schools is one of the most vital and least glamorous efforts in education, the unwanted job. So argues Alexander Russo in his new book, Stray Dogs, Saints, and Saviors, Fighting for the Soul of America's Toughest High School. In it, he chronicles the efforts of Green Dot Public Schools and its charismatic leader, Steve Barr, to transform South Central Los Angeles's deeply troubled Locke High School. Today we talk with Alexander about the Locke saga, what the media got wrong, and the people at the center of the storm, and what all of this means for President Obama's hopes for turning around the nation's dropout factories. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Alexander, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Alexander, glad to be talking with you here about your new book, which I enjoyed very much. You know, it seems to me that there's something of a boom going on when it comes to education narrative, books that don't just present ideas or research, but tell compelling stories. So I'm thinking about the Jay Matthews book, Work Hard, Be Nice, about the Kip guys, or Richard Whitmire's Chronicle of Michelle Rhee, The Bee Eater, and now your book about Locke High School. Why do you think these kinds of books are on the rise, and why do you think they're important?
I think the reason for that is that people have realized that there's a story, a human story, that people want to hear. Even the most hard-hearted policy wonk wants to know about real human beings faced with real situations. And there's also a Spencer Education Fellowship, which is funding some of these narrative efforts. I think those are the two main reasons.
So how come you decided to write the book about Locke High School and not write the book about Steve Barr?
It was tempting to write about Steve more than I ended up writing about him, but a lot of other people had written about him, and it's very easy to get into the cult of personality and education or anything else. I was attracted to his colorful demeanor, but I was equally attracted, if not more so attracted, by the things that Locke represented. A charter neighborhood school. There are very few charter schools that are neighborhood schools. A unionized charter. There are very few, as you know, very few charters that are unionized. So those two things. I actually came at it from a very wonky perspective. I was interested in this sort of rare thing that you rarely see.
So how did you go about doing the research for a book like this? I mean, it sounds like you hung out in the school for a year. Is that basically right?
That's basically right. I got the grant from the Spencer Fellowship. I got the Spencer Fellowship, and I went out a week a month. I'm based in Brooklyn. I went out a week a month starting in May of 2008 through June of 2009, and then every other month or so after that, and spent basically all day, every day at the school or up at the Green Dot headquarters.
Okay, so let's dig into the story. So you've got to give our listeners a little bit of background, first of all. Who is Steve Barr, and what's Green Dot Public Schools, and how did they get started?
Steve Barr is a new or different kind of education reformer. He comes to education from politics. He did Rock the Vote. He did Democratic presidential campaigns, and then he decided he needed to do something different. He started 12 small unionized charters in the Los Angeles area. And then he decided that he needed to do something bigger, better, and that was to try and turn around one of these massive broken high schools that every district has.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. So, right, he first made his name by starting these charter schools and, in effect, siphoning kids off from some of the large failing public schools around. And then he makes this decision that, what, it's just not going to get to scale fast enough?
What Steve and Green Dot found was that they felt like they weren't pressuring the rest of the Los Angeles Unified School System as much as they wanted to. Green Dot had a dual goal. A lot of charter management organizations have the same goal, which is both to provide great services to kids in their schools and also to reform or improve the rest of the school system. And the original goal of 100 small, successful Green Dot schools just wasn't going to be big enough. And so that's why they needed to go with a effort to turn around, to get and turn around one of the 46 neighborhood high schools in Los Angeles.
Now, do you think that Steve Barr was naive to have those kinds of ambitions? I mean, he talked about wanting to, in fact, take over the whole district.
Naive. No, I think that Steve is political, unabashedly so. He thinks in political terms, and he knew that he needed to create pressure and that this is the only way to go. Was Green Dot ready operationally, logistically? Not really. But this is part of what makes Green Dot so interesting is you've got both operational issues going on and you've got political reform issues going on. Steve's very strong and very clear on the political reform issues and had a very able deputy, Marco Petruzzi, doing the operational stuff.
Let's go back and talk a little more about Steve Barr. You said that, you know, he was involved in politics. He did rock the vote. And then what? He wakes up one day and just decides to be an education reformer?
You know, I think it was a little bit of a midlife crisis. He'd done a lot of things, had a lot of excitement in his life. He dabbled in politics. He lost his mom and he lost his brother. He wasn't sure what he wanted to do next. He saw what was going on at a couple of charter schools and realized that there was an opportunity here both to revive himself and to do some good.
Okay. And I'm curious, what was your relationship like with Steve Barr when you were working on this project? Did he cooperate with you?
By and large, he did cooperate. He was very, very open, especially at the beginning, as many people are at the beginning of a book or a news story. I met him a couple of times. I told him what I wanted to do. He said, here are the keys. We want you to tell the story. My relationship with him, like his relationships with lots of people, has had its ups and downs along the way. I have been in his business, so to speak, since 2008. Sometimes it's hard having someone looking over your shoulder all the time, asking you why you're doing things, asking you to reflect on things that didn't go so well. I guess the key thing is, though, is that he gave me the kind of access to a charter school organization I don't think anyone else has had. I'm not even sure that Jay Matthews got as into the dirty laundry in KIPP as I was able to get into with Green Dot.
Okay, so Barr decides that he's going to take over Locke High School. He has to get a majority of the tenured teachers to vote to convert the school into a charter school. So tell us, what happens?
He tries to get the teachers interested, and he struggles. He's not allowed on campus. The district and the administration are against this sort of, I call it a teacher trigger. There's some concern about the relationship between the district and Green Dot. Finally, though, the principal at the school, a principal brought in by the district, finally the principal declares that he thinks that something like Green Dot has to happen, that he's frustrated. He essentially sacrifices himself. His name is Frank Wells. He lets Barr and the Green Dot folks onto campus, and they and a small band of Locke teachers gather these signatures.
And then the principal ends up getting removed, right?
Principal ends up getting removed almost immediately. The teachers who participate in the petition effort they're protected by the contract, ironically enough, but they are punished in other ways. They lose their chairmanships. They lose their mentor-teacher positions. One of them, Bruce Smith, ends up being forced to sort of patrol the back corner of the campus during the time that he's there. There was a lot of payback.
Okay, so Green Dot gets the school. But now there's almost a whole year until it actually gets control.
Right. There was this awful limbo year where Los Angeles Unified was still ostensibly in control of the school, but had basically stopped paying attention. And Green Dot was ramping up, trying to get ready to take over, but wasn't in control. And this was actually Locke's worst year. The school was supposed to get better with this petition and with this rescue effort. And it actually, for about a year, got worse. And in the end of the year, there was a campus-wide melee, widespread fist fighting between students. A lot of it focused on conflicts between Black students and the Latino students.
Okay, we're going to hear about that and more when we come back with Alexander Russo, the author of Stray Dogs, Saints and Saviors, Fighting for the Soul of America's Toughest High School. You're listening to the Education Next Book Club. We'll be back in a minute.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Okay, we're back with Alexander Russo. Alexander, you were telling us about the limbo year at Locke. So this is when Green Dot is gearing up to take over the school, but hasn't yet. Now, one of the first things that Steve Barr and Green Dot have to decide is who's going to be the principal of Locke High School. And surprisingly, they choose a white woman. How did that go down?
That was not a very popular decision with some of the folks on campus who thought that Frank Wells, the old principal who helped Green Dot, was going to be asked back. Green Dot decided they didn't want to ask Frank Wells back, and they didn't want to elevate anyone on campus to be the new principal. They brought in this this rookie principal from Long Beach, which is a successful district to the south, and there were some people who were quite upset about it. New to the area, not the strong male African-American role model that a lot of people in the Locke community thought Locke needed.
So why not bring back Frank Wells, the old principal? I mean, he was the one who helped to push for the signatures and to turn the school over to Green Dot.
In a fair and just world, he might have been brought back, but the truth was is that he polarized a lot of the teachers at Locke, even those who appreciated his willingness to sacrifice his job and his awareness that the district was basically dumping on Locke. People weren't entirely comfortable with his brand of leadership, which was sort of old school top down. He's not an old guy, but he had sort of that old school top down mentality, and they weren't sure that they could work with him. And so he was a consultant to Green Dot for a year, and then flailed around a little bit. He's now back up in Northern California, where he's from, working at a school very similar to Locke.
Interesting. Now, the other fascinating thing is that the teachers who voted for the petition, by and large, left the school also.
Yeah, you just because you voted for Green Dot didn't mean you got or wanted a job. Some teachers wanted a job, but they weren't asked back. A lot of teachers who had voted for Green Dot didn't want to lose their lifetime health benefits, which would have been required if they had left UTLA and joined Green Dot. So there was a sort of a bureaucratic, a benefits issue that kept some of them from staying on. Others just weren't sure that the Green Dot was up to it. Green Dot is the equivalent of, I don't know, the kids running the lemonade stand telling you that they can run your business better than you can. And there were a lot of people who weren't sure that that was the case.
Okay, so we've got this limbo year when the district's not paying attention, Green Dot's not in charge yet, and at the end of the year there is, as you mentioned before, this melee. What happened?
So tensions between the Black and Latino students had been growing during the year. Watts used to be predominantly Black and is now predominantly Latino. But more than that, the students felt abandoned, were abandoned. A lot of the teachers were they were in limbo. They didn't know what was going on. And so this sort of low-level vandalism turns into arson, turns into, you know, four or five fights a day. And by spring, when the weather warms up and tensions are high, you know, these are teenagers. Teenagers are a little bit drama-prone in any case. There was a small fight that turned into a much bigger fight and turned into a national story, partly because the LA Times reporter Howard Bloom happened to be nearby and found his way onto campus. So Locke students and community members said that it wasn't actually as big a fight as the media made it seem. It was just that there was an LA Times reporter there covering and relaying all of these juicy details about ghetto kids going wild, and the media just, you know, loves that stuff.
And so how did that play when it came to this turnaround effort? I mean, this is just before Green Dot's officially taking over.
A lot of people think that it was the riots, or the so-called riot, that led to Green Dot taking over, which actually wasn't the case at all. There's a strange confusion about that. The truth of the matter is that the decision had already been made, and the riot was just sort of a sad hitting bottom that happened shortly after. It scared off some teachers, and made parents worried about sending their kids to the school. But the truth is, they were already scared about sending their kids to the school. A lot of parents avoided Locke at all costs. It had this unintended effect of making the following year, it made Green Dot look better. It had the effect of making the order and calm of the first year of the new Locke look better, just because there was no riot.
Interesting. Okay. So enter some very interesting characters. First of all, tell us about Zeus Kubias.
Zeus Kubias. I pretty much knew from the second I met Zeus that he was going to be a character in the book. He went to the school as a kid, graduated in the early 90s. He went off to college. He came back and taught math for a bunch of years, and then ended up being the rookie assistant principal in charge of a big group of Locke kids. He had a great name, was a colorful character, and he was the front man, if you will, for the Locke turnaround.
Okay, so tell us, so what was his role then at the school?
Zeus was put in charge of the Black Shirts, is what they were called, a group of sophomores, juniors, and seniors, about 800 of them, who were returning to Locke under the new system. So he went over to the Green Dot side and gave up his benefits. He was about 8 or 10 years in with UTLA and became a rookie assistant principal in charge of supporting the teachers, in charge of finding substitutes, in charge of making sure that everyone ate lunch and went back to class, in charge of pretty much everything.
And say again, these kids were called the Black Shirts. Explain that. What was that?
The Black Shirts. It sounds a little bit crazy. The school decided, Green Dot decided, as a lot of schools have, that it wanted to use school uniforms as a way of creating identity for the students, and also as a way of dividing up kids on campus. It's a massive campus. And so they divided the older Locke kids into white shirts and black shirts, and gave each of those schools within schools, I guess you could call it, an assistant principal. So Zeus was in charge of the Black Shirts, who wore black polo shirts and khaki pants. And another young administrator was in charge of the white shirts, who wore white polo shirts.
And my understanding is that Zeus was quite a character.
Zeus is a character. He's as much of a character in the book and in real life as Steve Barr. He is energetic, passionate about the school, runs around the school all day with this giant key ring, opening doors and closing doors and hustling kids in and hustling kids out. He has a bit of a foul mouth. Not in front of the kids, but in private, something he also shares with Barr. He was deeply committed to the school and the community. He was ambivalent about Green Dot. He, like a lot of other people, called Green Dot the Dot, and complained about some of the directives or some of the things that they were trying. He wasn't, for example, in favor of the uniforms, though he ended up being one of the main people to enforce the uniform. He didn't like having all of the private armed guards on campus. He thought that was a recipe for disaster, and turned out to be right about that. So he's in that classic position of signing on to do something new, but also still having loyalties to the old. And he was conflicted throughout the year, throughout the time, and characters like that who are working their tails off and trying to do something new, but also pulled back a little bit by their history. Those are fascinating characters.
I'm interested in something you just said, that the private armed security guards were a big mistake. I understand that the big focus that first year at Locke was student safety and keeping things calm. So what was wrong with having those armed guards on campus?
The real problem was that they were undertrained. Private security guards don't make much money. They oftentimes have a high school degree. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the ones that were hired for the job had worked in housing projects or malls or factories. they weren't used to or ready to the high level of interactivity that comes when you put a guard in a cafeteria or in a hallway. So they just weren't ready for that level of contact with human beings, especially for the delightful and annoying human beings known as high school students. So there was a lot of there were respect issues. The guards were both looked up to by the kids and also belittled by the kids, who called them, you know, rent-a-cop, and sang the song from sang the Bad Boys song to them all the time. They weren't trained enough, especially at the beginning, and that meant that sometimes there were conflicts and eventually led to some incidents. Nothing fatal or physical or anything like that, but there were some downsides to having them there.
But in the end, it was a very safe, orderly first year for Locke, right?
It was. And when I went around and asked the teachers and the staff about what they thought about the security guards, expecting them to say, oh, we didn't need them, we could have done this, it would have been better without them, a lot of them said, hey, there were some disadvantages, there were some moments where they were a little heavy-handed, but the truth is that they kept these kids from the surrounding streets. Locke is located in Watts, which is a very challenged part of South Central Los Angeles. They kept the kids safe. They made sure that any conflicts were ended quickly. I was surprised that the said that on the whole, to have them there.
Okay, so Locke has a pretty good first year, and right, you get to the end, it's time for graduation. Sounds like you were there to watch it. What was that like?
It was a pretty exciting time for everybody. They'd worked hard, they were exhausted, they'd kept the campus safe, they'd kept a lot of kids coming to class, and gotten a lot of kids across the line in terms of graduating. They were proud of what they'd done, and they had cameras and print reporters and all sorts of local celebrities there. It was a pretty exciting time, and Steve Barr showed up and gave a speech, and everyone, it was exciting.
Okay, well, we're going to hear a little more about the school and whether it is still heading on this successful track when we come back with Alexander Russo, the author of Stray Dogs, Saints, and Saviors. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Education Next Book Club.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Back with Alexander Russo joining us via Skype. Alexander, so the school has a pretty good first year. This was now a few years ago. You've had some time since then to watch it. Is this a success story?
I think it is overall. It's certainly not a miracle, and Green Dot wouldn't claim that it was. The school is substantially safer and calmer. The school is full of kids who are more academically oriented than they were before. Not just coming to school, they're going to class. They're not just sitting in class. They are paying attention, and they're even doing their homework. And that may seem like a very, very small thing, but for anyone who's been in one of these schools with a broken culture and a dispirited population, getting kids to come to school, go to class, pay attention, and do their homework is actually a pretty big accomplishment.
Sure. Now, some skeptics might say that when you look at a turnaround success story, what usually has happened is that the kids are different. That Diane Ravitch has said the only way you fix a failing school is you have the failing kids leave and different kids come in. Is there any evidence of that at Green Dot? Is there any evidence of that at Locke High School?
There isn't. Locke was and remains a neighborhood school. And one of the things that I was careful to watch was to see whether they continue to accept neighborhood kids, kids who've been kicked out of other schools, kids who wanted to move into the neighborhood or wanted to come back. And every week 5 or 10 kids showed up with their parents, said, hey, we want to come, signed in, and the school did a pretty remarkable job of attracting and staying open in a way that a lot of other schools wouldn't do. A lot of other schools sort of closed their doors on the first day of school in September and say, we're going to focus on the kids we've got here. Locke accepted kids the first year and subsequently throughout the year. It was a pretty admirable thing to do, a very challenging thing to do, as you can imagine. They took kids who were just getting out of juvenile camp. They had kids who were on house arrest, allowed to leave the house only to go to school or work. They took a lot of kids. They had a very strong ELL and special ed program. They weren't doing any miracles, let me be clear. There's no miracle story here. There's no perfect hero. There's no Superman of any kind. But they did make the school a lot better. And there are a lot of kids who, at the very least, have a high school degree that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Okay. So, you know, I think of you, Alexander, as a recovering policy wonk. And yet you seem to be very careful not to do too much in terms of policy implications here. But I'm curious, when you look at the Locke story and what else is going around the country in terms of turnarounds, are you now pro turnaround?
I feel like a charter neighborhood school is a really interesting idea. I feel like a unionized charter school teachers is an interesting idea. So I wish that there were more people trying this. There's a national school improvement program going on around, and I think you can make schools a lot better without swapping out the kids or even swapping out all of the teachers. I'm a little disappointed that there are only 30-something schools nationally trying something, and that's anywhere even close to what was tried at Locke. I feel like I'm hopeful that this second year, fall of 2011, I'm hoping that there'll maybe be some more folks who decide, hey, we want to work with an outside group. We want to try something that's more dramatically different rather than just bringing in a new principal or new teachers.
And now say that again, that you're saying that out of the 700 or so turnaround schools in the country, $1 million, we're just looking at maybe a couple of dozen that are using this kind of dramatic turnaround effort.
Right. One of the unfortunate elements of the school improvement grant program was that it didn't encourage districts to partner with outside organizations to do the turnarounds. So very few of them did. It's also true that very few outside organizations, charter management networks, for example, want in on this kind of work. There were very few the first year, and hopefully there'll be more the second year.
Now, I know you didn't want to write the Steve Barr book, and yes, there is a cult of personality, but I can't help but getting back to Steve Barr. He's such an interesting character. News recently that he has parted ways with Green Dot, the organization he founded. Curious to know what you think about that, and what your assessment of Steve Barr was in general. I mean, is he a visionary leader? Was he reckless? What's your take on Steve Barr?
All of the above. He definitely qualifies as visionary. He certainly qualifies as compelling and charismatic. He got a lot of people to do a lot of things that many thought couldn't be done. He and Green Dot ended up parting ways, which is not so unusual. A lot of founders in the private sector or in the nonprofit world, a lot of people who are great at starting things aren't great at running them or growing them. The news, it seemed to take a long, long time for Green Dot and Steve to finalize their divorce. As you said, that just happened in the most public way a couple of weeks ago. The split happened a year or two before. And in a perfect world, Steve would have stayed with Green Dot, and they would have pursued this dual strategy of both running charter schools and pushing for reform. But the reality is, as you and anyone else who's been involved with an organization knows, it's very hard to pursue two separate missions. And reform is a is a sort of a specialized mission, and running charter schools is a very different kind of specialized mission. I think it's interesting to note that we have now a slew, or at least a handful, of reform or advocacy-focused organizations starting now that are going to have very little to do with the actual direct operation of schools. I'm talking about Stand for Children and 50 Can and Michelle Rhee's organization. So I think Steve is a fascinating guy. I think of him as a polarizing and compelling figure, sort of like Michelle Rhee is currently. And I think of Locke as the prototype for something that could work, not just for turnarounds, but for schools in an ongoing way. Perhaps it's wishful of me, but I do think that this idea of a semi-autonomous neighborhood school whose teachers have enough protection from unreasonable mandates that they actually can imagine staying for more than 2 or 3 years. I think there's a sweet spot in there. And you interviewed Rick Kallenberg, and he's apparently writing a book about charters and unions. And I hope that there's a little bit more interest and growth in that area in the coming years.
That's great. So, Alexander, what's next for you?
I am working on a book. I came to education writing from a handful of years on the Hill, and I've always viewed education as a political issue, explicitly a political issue. And I am working on just the beginnings of a book about the switch in school reform, or the shift in school reform, from programs and services, direct programs, direct services, to advocacy and politics. And the book aims to try to track this shift towards education as a political pursuit, and to assess whether the people who call themselves reformers have the chops to really affect lawmakers and the political process.
Sounds great. Sign me up. I look forward to reading that. Well, thanks again, Alexander Russo, for joining us here on the Education Next Book Club, author of Stray Dogs, Saints and Saviors, Fighting for the Soul of America's Toughest High School. Alexander, good luck with your next book, and I hope when it's out, you'll join us again.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the time.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.